Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. It is time to talk about what I'm getting on, read about, do about, see about, listen about, think about. And let's be honest, right now, it's all about COVID. COVID-19, the coronavirus. There will be a break coming shortly. In fact, there will probably be a little bit of an edit where maybe we do a little bit of coronavirus, a little bit of other papers. But for right now, it's all corona all the time. And even if I really wanted to do other papers, which trust me, I do, I'm getting burned out on coronavirus. Most of the journals are all publishing on coronavirus. So it's actually a lot harder than you might think to come up with studies that are not about the coronavirus. But with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's kick this thing off. Question Medicine 2020. It is COVID. And the National Institute of Health came out with guidelines on COVID. This is so great. I bet it's going to be ground-shattering, earth-breaking. It's going to be wonderful, right? Except it probably says what you already know if you're listening to Question Medicine, and that is that the panel does not recommend any drug for pre- or post-exposure prophylaxis. They came right out and say, listen, we are recommending against hydroxychloroquine plus azithromycin outside of clinical trials because the trials that we do have are absolute crap. And they're also saying that we should not be using HIV protease inhibitors outside of clinical trials. If you're listening to Question Medicine, then you already knew that. You already knew that the trials were terrible. And I agree, we need trials to support anything that we're going to do. And right now, as this panel, as this guideline states, does not make a recommendation for specific antiviral or immunomodulatory treatments as no drug has been proven safe and effective. That is correct. Absolutely no drug for the treatment of coronavirus has been proven safe and effective. And let's be serious, it hasn't even really been shown effective, let alone safe. Oh, and one more thing that they recommend is no systemic steroids in those that are mechanically ventilated, so intubated, if they do not have ARDS or acute respiratory distress syndrome. If they have ARDS, well then you can go ahead and give them some corticosteroids. But let's move on from that article onto another article, which is another guideline. This time it's not a guideline about COVID. This time it's a guideline in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology titled Anaphylaxis, a 2020 practice parameter update, systematic review, and grading of recommendations. This article is not COVID. It is absolutely not COVID, and it's the only article that's not COVID that I'm going to talk about because I think that we in medicine do anaphylaxis terribly wrong. And we do it wrong because we just do it how we've seen it done time and time again, even though the person before us didn't do it the right way either. The lifetime prevalence of anaphylaxis is as high as 5%. The thing that I think everyone does wrong is the treatment. The treatment, they say, I gave an antihistamine, I gave a steroid, I gave blah blah, I gave blah blah. The thing that they don't say is, I gave epinephrine. As the guideline states, and I quote, epinephrine is the cornerstone of anaphylaxis management, but continues to be underutilized. And I couldn't agree more. Epinephrine is first line. Epinephrine is the only drug with proven, 100% proven benefit in trials. Second line treatment is antihistamine agents. Antihistamine agents are the second line treatment for anaphylaxis, but given their slow onset of action and inability to stabilize or prevent mast cell degranulation, they are not first line. And I know we all give steroids. We all give steroids thinking we're doing such a wonderful job, except as the guideline states, and again, I will quote this, although glucocorticoids are frequently used as an adjunctive therapy for anaphylaxis, evidence is lacking to support clinical benefit. Yes, it is. Evidence is definitely lacking. And I think that we give steroids because it makes us feel good. We think that we are doing something when really we're probably not. And we also probably think we're doing something because the person that we learned from, the person that we trained from, gave steroids, even though the evidence didn't support it then, and it probably doesn't really support it now. Now, I want you to note that I said steroids, not the beneficial, for the treatment of anaphylaxis. The guideline is very clear that this is only for the treatment. The guideline does give a low recommendation for giving steroids and antihistamines prior to interventions such as contrast and certain infusions and chemotherapy protocols. But the big take home from this paper, from this guideline, is epinephrine. If you're taking a test and they said, what's the treatment for anaphylaxis? The answer is epinephrine. If you are pimped on rounds and they said, what's the treatment for anaphylaxis? You should answer epinephrine. If anyone comes to you and they're like, oh my goodness, I'm having anaphylaxis, your answer should be, don't worry, I have some epinephrine. And with that, let's move on. Now that we've gotten that out of our system, let's go back to the coronavirus. There's been a big outcry recently about an antibody test. An antibody test is exactly what we need, everyone says. An antibody test. If only we had an antibody test, that would be amazing. Except there are two articles, one in the New York Times, that does an excellent explanation for those individuals who really think that it is beneficial. And then there's also one in JAMA, which I will link to in the show notes. Both of these articles talk about the inaccuracy of antibody tests. And even when they are accurate, we don't know what to do with the results. What if a patient has an antibody test and it comes back positive IgG but no IgM? Or maybe it comes back IgM but no IgG? Or maybe it comes back positive for both? What do you actually do with the results? No one really knows. And the other thing that no one knows is, does a positive antibody test prevent you from then getting and spreading coronavirus? We don't know. Maybe you get it, but you get almost no symptoms, but you're still able to spread it to other individuals. We don't know. And a lot of the antibody tests being released are being released by the FDA based on emergency situations, which means they don't actually have to prove that it's effective. They can just say things like, our test is 90% sensitive and 70% specific, or positive predictive value is 1 billion trillion. But if you go look at the data, they haven't actually proven that. In fact, I was not able to find one test, one antibody test, in which the company has actually released data that supports their claims. And a majority of these antibody tests are just telling you positive or negative. It's like a pregnancy test. They're saying positive, you have the antibodies. Negative, you don't have the antibodies. What we don't know is, what is your titer level? We don't know that having antibodies, low antibodies, makes you immune to anything. In fact, we actually don't know if having high levels of antibodies makes you immune to anything. So having a positive or a negative test doesn't really tell us anything. It is interesting. It is a great point of research. I hope that it pans out. But as we currently stand, we know nothing when it comes to this antibody testing, and we need more research. So if you want to get excited that we have an antibody test, well, that's okay. But you shouldn't be excited with a false sense of expectation that it's actually going to do anything, or that it is doing anything for what we really care about. Antibody testing is not the only problem with testing. Testing has been a problem this entire time during the coronavirus pandemic, at least here in the United States, and it will be a problem going forward. But many people say, well, there are no cases in my county. There are no coronavirus cases in my location, and that's because you have not tested anyone. You simply cannot find what you don't look for, which leads me to my next article. This is from the County of Santa Clara, in a paper or a public release from the County of Santa Clara that says, Santa Clara identifies 3 additional early COVID-19 deaths. That's right, the Santa Clara Medical Examiner identified 2 individuals that died at home on February 6th and February 17th, and the autopsy results are positive for coronavirus. That is right, positive for COVID-19. which is interesting because we in America until this time thought that the first case of coronavirus came over to the United States and was positive in Washington on February 26. But it turns out somebody died at home 20 days earlier in Santa Clara. This has probably been around for much longer than we think, and we don't know because we didn't test for it. So therefore, we couldn't have found it. Now, the answer for when will this all be over is a very easy one. When there is herd immunity. Either everyone gets a vaccine or everyone gets illness. This is when the anti-vaxxers are getting really quiet. They want a world without vaccines. And now that we have a world without a vaccine, it isn't so much fun. The sad thing is, I am sure there will be a time in the future when everyone will quickly forget how little fun a pandemic is, and once again, they will be protesting their right to refuse vaccine, which is depressing, but also satisfying because it's job security. I guess you just really can't fix stupid. But it's not all doom and gloom, my friends. Oh, no. There is positive news out of the CDC in their Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. In their report titled Assessment of SARS-CoV-2 Infection Prevalence in Homeless Shelters for U.S. Cities March 27th to April 15th, 2020, they used PCR to test resident and staff members in 19 homeless shelters. In the end, almost 1,500 people in total, and it was impressive that in those locations for which there was already at least two positive or two previous COVID-19 tests, they found the rate of positive cases was extremely high. 17% of the residents and staff members in Seattle were positive. 35% of those tested in Boston in these homeless shelters were positive. 66% of the residents in San Francisco homeless shelter was positive. This tells us what we already know, that this disease or this illness, this virus, will spread like wildfire once the community or the population is exposed to it. And everyone is equally affected. Some will need the intensive care unit, and some will be silent symptoms or just a mild cough. And that, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, is the scary part. There is no clear-cut sign of who is going to end up dead. Sure, it is definitely more likely that the elderly, more than anyone, will end up dead, will end up with the worst-case scenario. It's more likely that those individuals with comorbid conditions will end up in a body bag. But let's be honest with each other. That's the situation no matter what time of year it is or if there's a pandemic or not. If you're elderly, you're more likely to die. If you're elderly with comorbid conditions, you're still more likely to die. It is not 100% though, and there are some young individuals and some almost were healthy individuals that have ended up dead, which is the incredibly freaky part about this virus. This study from the CDC, or this press release from the CDC, also tells us that just maybe, this has already spread to more people than we think, and herd immunity is closer than we think, which is a far cry, but still a cry for hope. And speaking of hope, there are many things in medicine that I hope continue after this pandemic, and one of those are e-consults and telehealth. And in this paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, titled Utility, Appropriateness, and Content of Electronic Consultations Across Medical Subspecialties, a Cohort Study, it was a perfectly timed release, a perfectly timed paper to look at just this situation. The objective of this retrospective cohort study was to assess novel metrics of electronic consults, appropriateness, and utility. Now, the study looked at the primary care and specialty practices inside of a large health system like One Medical System out in California or Kaiser Permanente, which is also out west for those of you that are not aware. However, this could be done in almost any setting, I feel like. It definitely could be done in almost every academic setting. But the researchers looked at the data on over 6,500 e-consults from five different specialties: psychiatry, infectious disease, hematology, rheumatology, and dermatology. The e-consults were considered appropriate if they met the following criteria. 1. The question could not be answered by resources available at the point of care. 2. It only dealt with logistical information, so you couldn't be doing a procedure, which makes total sense. You can't do an e-consult for a procedure. 3, it was not highly urgent. And 4, it was not so complex that it requires an in-person consultation. Most of the consultations were answered within 24 hours, and approximately 70% of the consultations of all 4 met appropriateness, indicating that 70% of the time the patient could be spared a visit to the specialist and have their conditions managed by the primary care provider with just a subtle little guidance, a subtle little hint, a subtle little tip from the specialist. I think in the end, this is so beneficial for both the patients and the providers. No patient wants to wait 2 months to get into a specialist. No specialist wants to have pointless office visits that could have easily been handled or answered in a quick email response. And no primary care provider wants to feel like they are a referral monkey and just always sending out all their questions just for a simple, quick little answer. This is amazing. Hopefully, this can continue after COVID-19, and those specialists that answer these e-consults can be reimbursed for their time. This would make it so much better for everything, or rather, everyone. But speaking of things that would be better for everything or everyone, let's move on to this article from the American College of Chest Physicians in their expert panel, which says that it is appropriate to defer lung cancer screening and delay lung cancer evaluation during this COVID-19 pandemic. Just in case you were wondering if maybe, just maybe, you should do your cancer screenings right now. The cancer screenings out there that do not save all-cause mortality in these individuals. Well, the American College of Chest Physicians, the society that maybe has more bias for this lung cancer screening than anyone, has went ahead and said, don't worry about doing this right now. You can wait to do cancer screening until the pandemic is over, which means you can also wait for your mammogram and all other tests until the pandemic is over. Less screening for me is probably better for everyone. And with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. So let's wrap it up in about 30 seconds or less and discuss quickly the articles I talked about. New guidelines out from the National Institute of Health, which basically says, listen, we have no good treatment for this thing, so do what you need to do, but we don't recommend any treatment because there is no treatment. And unless the patient has ARDS or ARDS, do not give them steroids. Then we moved on to the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. Anaphylaxis equals epinephrine. That's really all you need to know. Second line is antihistamines and glucocorticoids or steroids. Yes, they make you feel good, but they're probably only making you feel good, not the patient. And speaking of patient-centered outcomes, patient-oriented events, how about testing for antibodies? Well, it does absolutely nothing so far. In fact, it only costs your patient money. You cannot do anything with the results because we don't know what the results actually mean. And that's on the premise that the results are actually true. We have up to a 5% false positive rate. That's a huge false positive rate when not that many individuals right now are actually testing true positives. So there is nothing to do with this test until it has been proven, till it has been proven true and true, tried and through. And even then, we have to know what to do with the test results. And currently, I haven't heard of anyone that has any good idea of what to do with the results. But I do know test results coming out of Santa Clara in an autopsy showing that coronavirus, the COVID-19 pandemic, likely started here in the United States well before we actually thought it did, when there was an individual who died on February 6th in Santa Clara that tested positive for COVID-19 now retrospectively. Well, that just makes me think this has been around a lot longer than we all want to believe. And before I wrap this up, don't forget that telehealth is hopefully here to stay, as well as e-consults. And a majority of the time in this paper, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, it is totally appropriate and it is totally okay to go ahead and use an e-consult. The patient is getting the same grade care, except they're not having to wait 2 months to get in the specialist. They're getting the same grade care, except you're not having to wait 2 months to get the results back. They're getting the same great care, except the specialist isn't having to waste their time with a pointless office visit that could have been answered with a simple email. And last but not least, be safe, be well, my friends, and do not worry about your cancer screening because, as the American College of Chest Physicians states, it's okay to wait until the pandemic's over. And if the American College of Chest Physicians states that it's okay for cancer chest CTs to be performed, and that is the only screening test we have that prevents all-cause mortality, well, then I am here to tell you that it is okay to delay the mammograms. It is okay to delay colon cancer screening for now. And with that, if you've learned anything during this podcast, I encourage you, I urge you, please send it out to one other person on the front lines, as hopefully we can all learn during this time. We are all scared and we all want to do what's best for the patient. So until next time, let me end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.